So my expertise is really on changing cultures. And this tool is one of the most fundamental and powerful tools I've ever seen change a culture. But it's because it goes, or you know, it's provided organization-wide, but it involves the loved ones at home. So you're not just stopping this and treating it like it's a resource while you're on the job. But then when you punch out at the end of the day, you don't have to worry about it anymore. No, this is a life change. And it requires the help of the people who love you the most. The message that it sent to those individuals reinforced the reason that they joined this profession in the first place.
Welcome to Respond Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Renee Thornton. She's a resilience expert and author at Pathfinder Resilience, talking about navigating adversity, tactical self-care for public safety professionals. Please like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're also on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and visit our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Dr. Renee after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMTB.
Today we're joined by a resilience expert and author at Pathfinder Resilience, Dr. Renee Thornton. We're going to talk about some very timely issues for first responders and look at how to decrease the impact of adversity on and off the job, and even before adversity strikes. Dr. Thornton holds a doctorate of crisis intervention, and I must say that she's one of only a handful of people in the world that have that qualification, and a master's in clinical mental health counseling, an MBA in international business, as well as dual psychology and communication degree. She served as a guest lecturer for Indiana University, Vera Dwyer College of Health Studies, John Jay School of Criminal Justice, and the John Jay School of Law and Police Science. A U.S. Navy veteran, Dr. Thornton is considered a pioneer in the field of public safety wellness and enhancing workforce performance. She's worked with numerous law enforcement agencies focusing on improving individual health and its implications on recruiting and retention, risk management, and organizational behavior. Dr. Thornton, welcome to Responder Resilience.
Thank you. Well, that really makes me sound pompous, doesn't it?
It's an amazing resume.
It makes you sound amazing. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Welcome. And thank you for your service as well.
Oh, that was completely my honor, honestly. When people thank me, I always feel a little weird because I think it was the best, the greatest gift I've ever been given. So it's not really... I don't know. I guess I don't look at it in a traditional way, but my pleasure.
Yeah. We look at it as a gift to all of us. So that's why we think. So tell us a little bit about your background. Tell us, how did you choose law enforcement?
Well, it's not just law enforcement. It's law enforcement, fire, EMS, 911, veterans, and their loved ones. So it's quite the audience, but it's all public safety centric at this point in particular. And the reason for that is because as a veteran, when I got out of the military, one of the first things that my friends and I and my shipmates who were also leaving about the same time as me, we decided that we would stay connected. And there were about a half a dozen of us, and we regularly got together. We would come together in Nashville, it's like a central location for us, and just do check-ins, you know, see how things were doing, catch up, stay connected. That was really, really important. And one day when we all came together, one of our members wasn't there. And we were all really surprised by this because he'd never missed a meeting. We'd all spoken beforehand and was under the impression he would be joining us. And we found out that he'd actually committed suicide. So before psychological autopsy was a term inside of the public safety community, I actually went down to where he lived and I walked back his life. And my assumption when I started that journey was that the trigger point for his suicide must have had something to do with his military service and some of the things that we had lived through and seen. And what I discovered was that that wasn't the case. His biggest struggle and that of a lot of us was assimilating into the civilian world after leaving a very organized, very purpose-driven lifestyle. And, you know, I started to speak with my other shipmates and I said, what was difficult about leaving for you? And the funniest response that I got that resonated so much with me and so many others is I would get up in the morning and open my closet and I would not know what to wear. I owned a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, no uniforms. There wasn't a uniform of the day. And I had to start all over from scratch trying to figure out, what am I supposed to even wear today? We are always deciding what we wear in the military based on the duties of the day. When you don't have that, you don't have that. you lose your footing. And what I learned over the course of time working with the veteran community and with public safety is that we're not struggling with the trauma nearly as much as we're struggling with the day-to-day. And I think that life skills are things that we are not necessarily taught anymore. And sometimes living life on life's terms can be more than we can handle. We get overwhelmed by it. And the notion that we no longer drive our own future leads us to a hopelessness that leads us to suicide. And that's where he was. So that's how I got involved in what I do today.
Well, some of this obviously crosses over into the world of first responders and particularly transitioning out of active service as a first responder. We've touched on it quite a bit, the loss of identity, loss of tribe, and how that also factors into that, you know, spiral that some go through leaving the job as they probably do leaving the military. So thank you for bringing all that up. And I wanted to dive into this because there's a lot of words we use in mental health and describing situations or conditions, but is the language we're using actually working, or do we need some new ways to talk about it?
You know, that's a great question, David. And what I have found is that words really do matter in this community. The reason for it is because when we focus on mental health, we just naturally activate the stigma that surrounds mental health. So inside of public safety, that's a major issue. It's one of four reasons that public safety professionals who are questioned 10 years apart from each other gave as why they would not seek assistance, because they're concerned about the stigma. And that answer has not changed. What I found is that by identifying the top adversities of the profession and speaking of them as adversities, they're real. We can't deny them. We can't deny that they exist. We can't deny that a high level of our public safety community is going to face one of these adversities or multiple adversities over the course of their careers. But we can stop acting like mental health is the only answer to how do we address the adversity that is in our life. When you speak mental health terminology, most people are going to shut off their ears and they're going to nod at appropriate places until you're done talking and then leave the room. What we do is, and this was a hard learned lesson for me because I kind of went into it, you know, scientifically, like, oh, okay, well, this is my theory. This is what I'm going to do. And I was really focused on like the mental health piece of it. Law enforcement and fire taught me to shift my mindset away from that negative aspect of the job and to consider the impact of building positive resources, which we ultimately now call positive wellness capital. And every bit of science and every bit of research and every bit of study that I have conducted in the last decade has really been focused on the influence of very specific types of wellness capital on very specific types of adversity. And when this is the verbiage that you use, you create a common language around positive things inside of an organizational environment, the stigma goes away because we're not talking about mental health anymore. We're talking about building positive capital. So this actually happened 3 years ago. I went into the San Francisco Sheriff's Office and we started working with them using the Navigating Adversity Training Program, which is focused on developing 8 different types of wellness capital and then measuring the influence of that wellness capital on the types of adversity that's most common to the public safety profession. The weirdest thing came from that research. Not only did we, you know, receive the same results that we have been receiving inside of every one of the public safety communities, but we also saw this really interesting phenomena happen where when people would start talking to each other, they stopped using questions like, how are you doing? Or what are you struggling with, you know, right now? Or you want to talk about it? Instead, they were saying things like, how's your psychological capital going right now? How's your spiritual capital this week? And so they were opening up about very specific aspects of their being and honestly having conversations around the positive things they're doing to build capital by dimension. And not once were they mentioning any of the adversities, because you don't have to. Everyone already knows which adversity lines up with which type of capital. So when you're talking about spiritual capital, you know that if you are working on building really high levels of it, you're defeating compassion fatigue. And so you don't have to say that. That's just what they know. So now they have a new common language. And since then, they've been speaking to each other. Organizationally, it's become a fabric of the culture. So that stigma has less of a hold.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
It's amazing how when you change one word, right, instead of mental health, you use wellness. That's more acceptable because wellness encompasses eating and going to the gym and lots of different things, right, that we know. So I find it so interesting that just that little switch makes such a difference. If you were talking to just any random first responder tomorrow and they asked you, what does wellness mean, how would you capture that?
Well, people are, first of all, really tired of that word. I mean, the 2023 employee trends data came out and this came from the Qualtrics team, and they had interviewed 30,000 employees globally. And one of the biggest things that came out of that research was the exhaustion with the word wellness. And so we dug like a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper into that, because obviously that, you know, that's kind of right to the heart of what we do. So we were like, great, we're not allowed to talk wellness anymore. That's problematic. But what we ultimately discovered was that wellness in terms of organizational practice is so frequently tied to a reactive measure that doesn't work, that people are tired of using that word, because we have traditionally done this. We have traditionally, like, we hire people, we screen them for very specific psychological skills. We don't tell them what those skills are, which is a huge mistake. Then we know they're perishable. So those skills start to, you know, defeat over time. They start to eliminate. And what you ultimately end up with is a type of adversity, whether it's depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress symptoms or substance abuse issues or relationship problems, whatever it is, it's going to happen if you don't do something ahead of time to prevent it from happening. Well, our resources, traditionally speaking, are only activated once a person is dealing with and deeply, deeply into the midst of adversity. So it's reactionary. People are tired of that. What they want is something that works beforehand. If we know that we're going to be facing these adversities, then we have a responsibility as leaders to step up to the plate to say, okay, we know the likelihood of you dealing with some type of adversity in the future is high. Therefore, we are going to do our due diligence and mitigate risk in the meantime by teaching you what you need to know to build positive wellness capital. So wellness, to answer your question, Bonnie, is really defined by the amount of investment each person has made or is making in their physical, cognitive, emotional, spiritual, financial, social, professional, and psychological health.
Okay.
And it's, it's such an easy reach now to think of it in terms of capital. We've had the amazing Roger Ruge on a show, and he likes to speak about, you know, having a bank account for that capital, resilience capital, resiliency capital. And so what are some of the ways that we can be proactive? I mean, you spoke about, you know, teaching these skills, kind of making sure they're not perishing over time. In real life, how do you deliver it in such a way that people are building up those accounts?
Well, we developed the Navigating Adversity training course specifically for that reason. And, you know, it's unlike any other course for a number of reasons, but primarily because it was actually created to be delivered virtually. Because, you know, one of the biggest objections in the public safety profession is they don't want to access mental health or wellness resources that are not confidential and private. That they actually have to worry about being seen. Do you know how many police officers I've talked with who've been sent to a therapist and they will actually drive around the block 6 or 7 times looking behind them to make sure that they're not being followed. And they'll park, you know, 6 or 7 blocks away from the therapist's office so that no one knows that that's where they're going. Like these measures they're taking are great measures. And I respect the reason that they're afraid. Sometimes in some cities, they have reason to be afraid. So when we created Navigating Adversity, we put a lot of extra safety measures into the process, but we purposefully created it so that it could be delivered online from anywhere, like an app or a tablet or a computer. But we didn't want anyone to feel like they were learning this very personal lesson by dimension in front of other people. And we wanted to provide them an atmosphere and environment where they can practice the tools that they're being taught in the privacy and comfort of their own home. And that's really important because some of the tools they're all over the place. They're everything from writing with the correct color ink, by the way, that matters, to mindfulness activities, to using a Headspace app for some guided meditation. Some yoga is involved. There's breath work. There's physical awareness work. I mean, there's just so much that offers it as options. Because the other thing about it too is you're going to run into some public safety professionals who don't feel comfortable with any kind of woo-woo. And you know, Roger Ruge, he's like the master of woo-woo. And this is a man who we love having on our team because he's tried and tested a lot of therapeutic techniques. And we know what works, but we also know that some people aren't ready for some of those techniques and some people are. So we've overpacked the learning experience with techniques that run the gamut of, I don't want to do anything touchy feely to, I'm totally down to, you know, like play some meditation every single day. You know, so there's a lot of that and they're learning it in a comfortable private space and they're practicing it that way. And they're connecting with, adversity coaches who are from their profession, of which Roger is one. So when you can talk to someone like Roger Ruge, who has lived through complex post-traumatic stress, who's gone through EMDR, who purposefully and intentionally pursues every avenue of wellness there is, you're talking to someone who's been there and who's gotten himself out of a pretty deep hole. And so, you know, if he can do it, so can I. And that camaraderie is a piece of the military that I think Navigating Adversity brings with it. And it encourages each other. We say it's not therapy, it's community for a reason. So that's what we're really trying to build is a community of public safety professionals who are prioritizing their own well-being.
And I can't let you go any further without explaining, why does the color of ink matter?
Okay. Well, if you're a pen user, the color blue activates the creative resources inside the mind. If you're a pencil person, the sound of pencil on paper activates the creative resources in the mind. So it's really important to know what works. And when you connect to those resources, what happens is that your mind actually opens up and brings you to like the full use of all of your senses. And so you're not necessarily closed off when you're sharing, like writing about a past experience. You're not just focusing on the facts, you know, just the facts, ma'am. No, when you're using a blue pen, believe it or not, your brain will allow you to emote in a more confident and comfortable way. It comes out a little more naturally. So it's just a nice little resource.
I'm curious, before we go on, what does a red pen mean?
You know, it's interesting. That's a great question. The use of a red pen can sometimes elicit fear in people's minds. And that comes from when we're children and teachers use red pens to mark our papers. Anytime that red was used, it was always sort of like a stop. It's not good. You know, right. Something you've done wrong. So we try to avoid red pens. Yes, danger at all costs. That is not a good color to journal with.
No, this is fascinating. Unless you're angry and you're trying to get some bad jujus out.
Now that I really agree with.
Yes.
Get the bad juju out. Then right from that moment.
No, it's incredible. You know that such little nuances matter so much, right? And when you work with people, you start to learn those interesting nuances. And I was wondering, just to segue into the next portion of our talk. In all of your research and all of your experience, why do you think public service agencies have such a hard time embedding wellness into their culture?
Well, I'm going to give them a little bit of credit. First of all, wellness has only really been a topic of their interest for the last decade. They've taken it seriously, I should say, for the last decade. It's not something they didn't know about before, but it was such a taboo topic that what we had resource-wise was pretty surface level, we'll say. In the last 10 years, I've watched a change, a shift in mindset and a shift in leadership in a lot of departments, which has helped, because with younger leaders comes an openness to testing and trying new things and being pioneering. But, you know, the other thing about it is I've only been researching the efficacy of starting from the positive perspective for a decade. And so a lot of the tools that they're activating and using or detailing as a wellness resource, they're really outdated and they're not doing what we want them to do. So we have these tools. They're a part of the culture, if you will. People aren't using them though. And they'll tell you straight up, I'm not calling EAP. Absolutely. I won't do it. I'm not activating my peer support resource. Like, I'm dealing with that right now with a department. They don't trust peer support. They love the individuals and they think they're great. But once upon a time, 20 years ago, one of those people who's not even in the department anymore talked about a person without permission. And ever since, the trust has been broken and no one's going to use it. So we have our own bias tied to traditional wellness resources, and we will not activate them by and large inside the public safety community. Now, it's appropriate to make sure that we offer those resources, because if you don't, then you're definitely failing. But we've only had proof for about a decade that something like navigating adversity, where you're building positive wellness capital up, actually defeats and diminishes the influence of adversity. And so getting the word out and letting people know that they really should be looking for a validated resource, which is a conversation we're not having often enough. That's the challenge that we're at right now, because the snake oil salesmen out there, they've got more money than I do, and they have louder voices and stronger reputations. And unfortunately, they're at every conference piddling their wares to try to make money off of the distress of others, to put it in, you know, very simple terms. So until leaders learn to ask the question, has this been tested inside my community? and against what? So that I know that your, you know, learning outcomes are what we expect them to be. They're going to continue bringing in wellness resources that have very little efficacy. And really, frankly, what we've discovered is that they have a minimal impact time-wise. So they're, it's like going to a motivational seminar. Everybody feels good coming out of a Tony Robbins experience. Everybody can change the world and, you know, become Aladdin. That's not reality. And in about 5 days, that excitement's going to wear off and you're going to be facing reality. And so we have to stop trying to use feel-good methodologies to address real distressful symptoms that people are living with. So that's where we're at.
Okay.
And just to kind of tag on to what you're speaking about, in terms of symptoms, so how can a law enforcement officer, firefighter, paramedic, EMT, 911 dispatcher, how can they recognize those symptoms that something's going on, and whether it's in them or maybe one of their coworkers? And what next steps do you recommend?
That's a great question. You know, I think the smartest and simplest awareness exercise, I think, for recognizing symptoms of distress is to pay attention to change. That's the biggest thing. If you think about it, when you come into this profession, people are so excited and they're so passionate and they're driven and they're like motivated to make a change, to make a difference, to make an impact on their community, to protect, to serve, you know, to provide a resource when you're in your most dire moment of need. There is a level of true excitement and passion and purpose that's tied to that initial entry into the profession. Leaders need to be responsible enough to get to know their people well enough to be able to identify when something changes. When your attitude shifts, pay attention to that. When you would rather go to the bar rather than go home, pay attention to that. That's not necessarily meaning that you have a drinking problem. It could mean that there's a relationship issue that needs to be addressed at home and you're trying to avoid it. You know, it could be your sleep cycle has changed, and our tendency in public safety is just to point to the job and say, well, you know, that's normal, or suck it up. It'll fix itself. We'll deal with that another day. A sleep cycle change is an early indication that there's a problem, whether that's an anxiety issue or a depression issue or a post-traumatic stress issue. Hypervigilance is another one of those things. If you find yourself being jumpy, unnecessarily, or constantly watchful, you're not shutting down your sympathetic nervous system properly at the end of the day. I mean, that's the other thing. We're not really teaching people about sympathetic dominance and the disorder that attaches to that. More importantly, if we would just teach people how to activate their parasympathetic systems, then they would train their brain to come down off of that high. You know, so it's just an awareness thing. It's like noticing the changes that take place and then stopping long enough to address those changes and figure out what is at the root causing the problem. If you can do that, you're way ahead of the game.
Come on.
Check it.
You know, one of the key things I see with working with first responders is, you know, we can talk in the office about how to calm down. We can talk about the amygdala. We can talk about all the strategies to use. But the one complaint I always get is, I understand all of that, but when I'm at the mall or but when I'm at the store, like, I need to know what's going on around me. I need to know where the exits are. So there's this kind of acceptance, you know, and I think it's part of the identity piece because it does become such a part of your identity. You know, they say things like, well, I can't unlearn that. You know, I can't unlearn how I think when I'm in a public place or when I'm with my family and I see my kid go outside without a helmet, you know? So I feel like that is the hardest one to manage and to give strategies for. And maybe it's partly because I have that brain too.
Well, you know, the thing about it, Bonnie, is that that is not necessarily a negative thing. You know, having a certain level of awareness, and this is another piece that I think that is super powerful. Giving people permission to be who they are frees them of the belief that they're carrying around some negative, you know, well, these are negative behaviors. No, they're really not. They are what uniquely qualifies you for this job, frankly. And we don't want you to lose your edge. We just don't want you to allow your edge to run your life. And so there's a balance there. And so asking yourself, and probably one of the best questions that you learn in this class, is the question of what can I control and what is outside of my control? Focus on the things I can and let the other ones go. But the other thing is, you know, back to that, we hire you for very specific psychological skills. If we would just tell people what those skills are, I think we would help them with a certain level of acceptance for the fact that that's a great thing. That's a really great characteristic to bring into the public safety profession. We don't want you to lose that. We don't want you to embrace it and let it run your life. But when we say that to people, we give them permission to be themselves instead of convincing them that they are supposed to meet some standard that we really don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think we can be cruel amongst peers. That somebody who's actually brilliant in some way in their job as a first responder sometimes gets, you know, picked on or their stones busted because they are so good at it in a way. You know, it's like it's almost like they're brilliant, but I've seen it become an area where they actually get, you know, picked on for it. And it always always saddened me to see that happen because then we're not appreciating them for what they bring, right? They are. Mm-hmm. They have beautiful skills and talents and abilities, but sometimes they're just not supported that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, and it Absolutely. Happens the opposite way too, which is sad, right? The people that don't have some of the skills or they're black and white thinking and can't think outside the box, you see that part of it too.
Well, when we talk about tribes, you know, the notion of a social tribe is a part of navigating adversity. And there's a professional tribe, too, that you're a member of. And recognizing that each person brings a unique skill set, a unique temperament to their job is something that we should be celebrating and not bullying. And frankly, we see bullying as one of the primary issues organizationally, as far as organizational behavior is concerned. Inside of public safety, bullying is a major problem. And it's primarily driven by a lack of understanding of the makeup, you know, the mix that happens inside of the profession temperament-wise and how each person fits a unique and necessary aspect of the career. So it's, again, we're kind of missing the opportunity to, and I think it's not intentional, but public safety professionals hate it when you refer to them as heroes. Most of them, they don't really like to be called heroes. They don't like to be, you know, heralded as unique or special or different, but we have to acknowledge the fact that they are, or they wouldn't qualify to do the job. And by ignoring that acknowledgement, we're missing an opportunity to really help them understand themselves in a way that will carry with them for the rest of their careers, an appreciation for what uniquely suits them and the people they're working with for the job. It would eliminate a whole lot of this, well, you don't have this, or you're not good at this. Or what. No, because everybody had to meet certain standards, and they're pretty high to get there in the first place. So let's start on equal footing, and then seek out the things that uniquely separate us from one another.
Right. I would say that's also something that leadership can do to put the spotlight on the things that people bring to the job that are unique and brilliant. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they do it and sometimes they don't. But I think when it's coming from a place of leadership, then there's probably more propensity for the rank and file to say, oh, yeah, you know what? This person is really doing something amazing. They bring something really cool to the job. So I think our leaders can step up a little more in that particular area.
Well, the other sad thing, too, it's like stepping right back into middle school, right? The people that do the bullying are the ones who are completely insecure. And so maybe the leaders, you know, I'm a past leader. Maybe we need to find, why are those people insecure? What are deficits? What are things we could bring to the environment that would give people more skills, you know? And maybe the challenge of that would keep everyone busy rather than figuring out how to pick on each other.
What we found is the bullies are depleted, you know? So when we talk about wellness capital, like Roger on your show was speaking about the bank account, you know? So what we find is people who are bullying other people inside of a work environment, they are at a, at such a low level of wellness capital that they're borderline bankrupt. You know, they're emotionally or cognitively bankrupt. And there's always a stemming cause to that. You know, it's like my relationships are falling apart at home, so I only feel powerful at work. So I take that power and use it to whatever my advantage is in the moment. And if that means that you're at the mercy of my ego, then by God, that's what I'm going to do. So it's not just an insecurity. It's generally like, I don't have anything positive built up in my own life, so I'm going to feed off of someone else and make them feel bad for it in the meantime. And we call those people energy vampires, and they're everywhere in their work environment. When you position it like that, you don't even need to say the word bully. People are like, oh, I know a few energy vampires that I work with. They're exhausted. They are depleted, and they need that reinforcement. So that's the answer.
Well, the end part of that is that they end up depleting the environment and everyone around them. And that's the symptom. Yeah. Those are the symptoms that we see in the agencies. And that's why there's so much burnout. And a lot of it's personnel issues. It's not the actual calls. That's what I see in my office all the time.
Yeah, 100%. That feeds the research, Bonnie. You're right there. The calls are not the problem. The traumas, the critical incidents, they're not the problem. And the reason we know they're not the problem is because we screen for people specifically who have the psychological capability of setting aside the trauma of the moment and dealing with its fallout later. That's why we screen people out. So we know that we have that psychological capacity for a great deal of critical stress. What we have not accounted for is the other stuff. It's the learning how to work together. It's having financial plan and having solid, strong relationships and choosing your tribe and working on building cognitive capital and regulating your emotions. Like, these things we are not teaching and focusing on. And so what we find is people who are struggling inside of public safety are not struggling because of a critical event. Most of them are struggling because of life in general. They're great in uniform, but take that off, they're not in charge anymore. And that's a very scary place to be, especially when you don't really know what you don't know. So that's why the eight dimensions of wellness capital are so important to people, because as they discover what these are, they're applying them to their own situation going, holy cow, no wonder I've been feeling off. No wonder I'm not engaging at a level that I once did. Or so that self-awareness just breeds this excitement to learn more and to build more. And in the meantime, you're just naturally overcoming whatever adversity is striking you at the moment.
And my question is, so we talked about the dimensions of wellness capital, and we talked about some of the ways that you show people how to implement that sort of offline, like, you know, off the job, so to speak. But are there ways that they can be used on the job, in the middle of running calls, in the middle of doing a shift? Are there ways that people can build up that capital?
Absolutely. In fact, some of the tools that we teach people to use, like, for example, in the spiritual capital realm, there are a number of options, but what works the most is something that you carry with you that reinforces your purpose. So we have a lot of people who in the law enforcement profession will write the police officer's creed on a piece of paper, and they'll put it in their wallet, or they'll put it on their visor in their car. And then after every call, they'll actually take 30 seconds to read that. Or they'll write down their favorite three Bible verses, or they'll write down, you know, some inspirational quote that somehow can center them back to the reason that they do this job. it doesn't take much, but that reminder is powerful. And it makes an impact, not just on, and this is the awesome thing about it, every single one of the tools in this training are multidimensional in impact. So it doesn't just influence your spiritual health, it also influences your cognitive wellness, because you're putting aside what just happened and refocusing and recentering yourself to prepare for the next call. It reinforces your emotional health because, again, you're connecting to the reason you're doing this job. And there's a gratefulness activity that people can learn how to do. I mean, there are just a ton of them. So it's on the job. We even teach people how to build capital while they're transporting a prisoner. So there's nothing you can't, not one of these tools that you can't actually activate whether you're on the job or off. And that's what makes them so great, because they're really flexible to your schedule and to your use preference.
That is great.
This is fascinating stuff. And I think you're doing such great work, and you're finding ways to integrate it into the daily life, because that's the other obstacle that occurs, right? Is I don't have the time for that, or it's not just presented to me, so therefore I'm not going to do it. But you're giving people these tangible small changes. And it's the small changes with consistency that really make change over time.
Absolutely. Well, and we also engage the most powerful resource that we have at our disposal, which is the loved one at home. You know, I'm like, when we do this, we obviously, it comes through the organization, right? So the agency says, we're going to do this. Everyone in the agency is going to go through navigating adversity, and you're going to learn about the adversities that are common in this profession. But more importantly, you're going to learn how to build really positive self-care resources and habits and practices. Oh, and by the way, you can invite your spouse to also take the class, so that when you go home, you can reinforce this stuff and he or she can say, how do we do this at home? And then they make it happen, which is so often what our loved ones want. But, you know, we kind of, when we're in that public safety world, it's like we're closing the door to our loved ones and we don't overshare too much with them. So depending on the couple, someone could come home and say absolutely nothing about their day, or someone could come home and just verbal diarrhea their entire experience. But that loved one, they've been asking for years to be a more integral part of the public safety world and to learn how to support the people they love the most. So why would we leave them out of this experience? No, I'm finding that the spouses are the ones saying, you do have time for this. You want to know why? Because we just made some. And then it changes the whole family dynamic, because you can invite your kids to be a participant in it and teach them some really healthy coping mechanisms. So it really should be. So my expertise is really on changing cultures. And this tool is one of the most fundamental and powerful tools I've ever seen change a culture, but it's because it goes, or, you know, it's provided organization wide, but it involves the loved ones at home. So you're not just stopping this and treating it like it's a resource while you're on the job. But then when you punch out at the end of the day, you don't have to worry about it anymore. No, this is a life change, and it requires the help of the people who love you the most. So they participate in it as well, if they want to.
Well, it's powerful too, because again, talking about transitioning out of a career or anything that's a tribe like that, when you're done, you have your first family is who you go home to. And if you've established a baseline, a foundation like you're describing, it must make a powerful impact in a positive way.
Well, we're finding in our research that the impact to the individual's wellness increases by 30% when a loved one is involved. That's a tremendous number. So if you can deliver this individually, it does help. You can deliver this workforce wide, and then you're changing the culture of your organization. And we even teach organizational leaders, like, how do you use the fact that this is an organizational wide self-care endeavor in your recruiting verbiage? Because now people who are looking for a job are looking for culture fit. And they don't want to be treated like a number, and they want that backed up with action. Well, there's no more powerful way of telling someone we care about you than to bring them into a career path that says, first things first, you're going to make yourself the priority because you can't help if you're empty, you know? So that changes the fabric of the culture. And then things change in the family when they feel like they're part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
Amazing. But we've covered a lot of incredible material and it's a lot to unpack and digest, but is there anything that we didn't cover you'd like to speak about?
We did cover a lot. I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I think it's really important for people to know that we have different versions of navigating adversity for different public safety demographics. And that's to honor the nuances. You know, the 911 operator's challenges are different from the law enforcement officer's challenges, and they're different from the fire professional's challenge. We also have the opportunity for couples to go through this together, which is different from the loved one's version because loved ones are not always couples, and couples approach things differently, right? So when they're a united front, then it's all about how do you integrate this into our relationship and into our, you know, individual selves. And we, you know, it's funny, we offer different support to the community in really non-traditional ways. So for example, my son is a content creator on YouTube. Like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with like what the content creator universe is like, but he's basically a gamer. But he's an entrepreneur and he runs his own YouTube business. Well, people find that they're struggling right now to effectively communicate boundaries and things with their kids because they're very technologically driven. And there's that gap there. Well, part of culture change, particularly for more progressive leaders in public safety, is to care about what kind of a toll being a parent is taking on their employees. That's been one of the most common sort of challenges that's come up over the years that I've heard from people on the force or in the 911 centers. I can't focus at work because I'm worried about this situation and it has to do with my kid and his gaming tendencies and his anger issues and, you know, fill in the blanks. So I actually started a class, like a training workshop for parents who are trying to raise healthy gamers, you know, healthy kids in this world of technology. And the only reason I bring that up is because the impact on the attitudes of the people inside of a police department, and I'm talking like SWAT guys and very serious people who you would never in a million years even guess that they emotionally cared so much about what's going on with their teenager. They were so in so much strife over how to communicate effectively with their kids that it was distracting them on the job. The department said, well, let's do this workshop and let's see what happens. So we did the workshop and holy smokes. People were just like, wait a minute, the department isn't putting us through yet another training class. This is actually something that's helping us on a personal and individual familial level. The lessons they learned were awesome, of course, you know, because it's a great class. I'm not trying to plug it or anything, but it's really fun. But the message that it sent to those individuals reinforced the reason that they joined this profession in the first place. And afterwards, I've talked with every single person who was there, and every one of them resoundingly said, I feel more connected to my command now than ever before. I'm not going anywhere. So as a retention strategy, it kind of like rose to the top, like, wait a minute, all we have to do is do something that shows that we care about their life outside of the job. Duh. Exactly.
That's pretty simple when you think about it.
That's such a long way.
Right.
It's not a traditional thought. It's not, yeah, it's not right. What we've ever been trained to think. It's not right. How we approach no. problems. We are very siloed in our thought processes. You know, we are a victim of groupthink, frankly, in public safety, because we don't very often reach outside of the profession for solutions. And so this was like mind-boggling to them. And now they're embracing this notion and they're creating all kinds of opportunities for, you know, appealing to the needs of the individual beyond the uniform. And now all of a sudden the culture is thriving and people are happy to go to work, which rarely happens today in this profession. So it's working when we treat individuals like individuals and we show them that we care more than their performance.
That's great. Well, great stuff.
Absolutely great. And where can people find you? Kind of learn more about your work and your training on the internet or social media.
Okay. Well, navigatingadversity.com is the website that speaks specifically to the tactical self-care training program. And pathfinderresilience.com is the website for our company that talks about culture and some of the culture work that we do. And then you can email me directly to renee@pathfinderresilience.com.
Great. Well,
this has really been great. Thank you so much, Dr. Renee.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Great. Yeah, we totally appreciate where we've gone in this conversation, and the work that you're doing is groundbreaking, to say the least. And it's going to have, obviously, is having a huge impact on the brothers and sisters and all the public safety professions. So much gratitude for you for what you're doing out there.
Well, again, this is one of those things where it's really my honor. I'm not really sure gratitude is necessary, but you know, at the end of the day, many hands make light work. And I feel like there are so many really great people who are focusing their efforts and time and attention on preventing suicide in the public safety community. And that's where I started, but it's not where I ended, because what I've discovered is that I don't want people just to not die. I want people to live and love their lives again. And we've discovered that that's possible. And I feel like that's a message that we really need to we need to be more aggressive with in reminding people that life shouldn't be a drudgery. It should be filled with joy. And that's kind of where we're trying to help point people to, and cultures too, because organizations, they should be a fun place to be again. So together we can make it work.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Dr. Renee Thornton, thank you again for being with us. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you continued success.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Remember, like and subscribe on our YouTube channel. It's Responder Resilience. Check us out on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV. We're also on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and visit our website, respondertv.com, past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.